From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Ain't I a Woman? Abolitionist Sojourner Truth posed the question more than a century and a half ago. Truth, a former slave, helped frame a complex face-off between race and gender. The clash breaks down to which side she'll choose, her gender or her blackness. Today, the Clinton-Obama race has brought the issue to a rolling boil for some high-profile feminist leaders. A multiracial group of female activists, journalists, and educators have been debating who should get to be America's first in the Oval Office, a black person or a woman. The argument got so heated that a meeting was called recently to smooth things over. What helped spark the conflict? A New York Times op-ed penned earlier this year by veteran feminist Gloria Steinem. In a few minutes, I'll talk with one of the women who pushed back at Steinem's piece. But first, Gloria Steinem joins me now. How are you? Welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you very much.
So do you see this debate as a question of what part of your identity you choose or how you interact with people who have different hopes and dreams based on who they are?
No, I don't actually. And what the point of my piece in the New York Times was to point out the misogyny with which Hillary was being treated, but also to say, as I did, that I would be happy to support Barack Obama. So, you know, it seems to me that the important thing here is that Barack Obama is a feminist and Hillary Clinton is a civil rights advocate. And this is a historic year in which we have two very good candidates, both of whom have raised the standards.
You were a New York delegate for Shirley Chisholm when she made her White House bid in 1972.
And yes, I'm proud of that.
Yes. Yeah. So she was seen even back then as a long shot, a black, female, outspoken. How are the stakes different now, given that we have both what we call viable female candidate and a viable black candidate?
Well, Shirley Chisholm was not a viable candidate. She was only on the ballot in a few states. But it was a crucial candidacy because she took the white male-only sign off the White House door, and we all owe her a great debt of gratitude. She herself, based on her own experience, felt that it was more difficult to be a woman in political life than to be an African-American, which is what she always used to say. But it seems to me that those situations can only be judged by the individual who's in them.
Now, how do you feel when critics say you're forcing women to either be down with the feminist camp by voting for Clinton or against that camp for opting for Obama? And
I think that's ridiculous. You know, I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever. The question, I mean, they're pretty similar on the issues. It has to be a coalition of sex and race. There are two caste systems, as I said in the column, that can only be uprooted together. The point is to oppose them both. The problem is that much of the media is ranking them rather than linking them.
But that was essentially the phrase "either or feminist" was written into a response to your op-ed by Kimberly Crenshaw, who we'll speak with in a minute.
And that's a misunderstanding of what I was saying. It's not either or, and I think that we came to a much better understanding of that by having coffee together with a lot of other women.
Tell me about that meeting. It has gotten in certain circles a lot of play as this, you know, meeting of great minds. And do you think that it accomplished what you hoped it would accomplish in terms of bringing together a dialogue between women of different points of view, black and white, but on a broader level, people who saw differences in the approach of feminists to election 2008? Do you think it accomplished what you wanted it to accomplish?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it made clear that we have to keep talking so that we're not pushed apart by the idea that sex and race are competitive here, or that you can't be a feminist and support Barack Obama, which of course you can. So I thought it was, I hope and believe that it was helpful in that regard. We'll see when we make sure that we all unify on whoever the candidate is.
Before I let you go, it seems to me that some people are staking out a claim that is not at all receptive to the other candidate becoming the nominee. I've heard from Clinton supporters who say, I'm not going to vote for Obama, and Obama supporters who say, I'm not going to vote for Clinton. And that says that whatever kind of big tent there is in the Democratic ranks could be pulled apart by some of these divisions. Do you see that? And if so, what could be done about that?
I don't think so. I mean, that would have to be, you'd have to be something of a masochist and an insecure one or immature one at that, because it's the issues that are important, and we are united on the issues, and it's terribly, terribly vital to this whole country, not to mention much of the world, that we defeat McCain. So to allow some personal feelings to interfere with the larger good of ourselves and the country just wouldn't make sense to me. So I hope and believe that we are going to be united on either one of these candidates.
Well, Gloria, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Gloria Steinem is co-founder of the Women's Media Center, and she joined me from New York. Now, to give another perspective on the intersection of race and feminism, we've got Kimberly Crenshaw. She's a professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles, and at Columbia University. How are you?
I'm well.
So when we spoke with Gloria, she said, this is not a case of either or. You happen to be an Obama supporter. You co-wrote a response to Gloria Steinem's piece with Eve Ensler. What is really going on here? How are things breaking down, and are they really breaking down, between black and white women?
Well, some would say that it's not so much a breaking down, but the division that's always been there is coming to the surface. Look, the real thing that caused us to want to write the piece wasn't so much that some people could look at the two candidates and see that a vote for Clinton made sense for them or a vote for Obama made sense for them. What we were really concerned about was the deployment of feminism to make a particular kind of argument. That is, that gender is the most restrictive force in American society, that black men get things before white women do, that they got the vote before white women did, that they have more access to power than women do, that they have more access to business than women do. And we just thought that this is precisely the kind of ranking of oppression that for the last 20 or 30 years, all of us feminists basically said that we weren't going to do anymore. So we were shocked, stunned, appalled, angry that these arguments would be rolled out, even as those who make them claim that they weren't making ranking arguments. So that's essentially what we wanted to call out in our piece, and we wanted to discuss it more face-to-face.
I want to read you a little bit of something that former vice presidential candidate Geraldine Ferraro said to a reporter from an L.A. publication called The Daily Breeze. She said, and this was just earlier, a few days ago, if Obama was a white man, he would not be in this position, and if he was a woman of any color, he would not be in this position. He happens to be very lucky to be who he is, and the country is caught up in the concept. Is that an example of what you're talking about?
That is one of the most infuriating, and there are many more. Look, the reality is that if Hillary Clinton were not a white woman, she would not have been the first lady. She would not have had this 8 years of on-the-job experience that so many people are willing to offer up. She would not be part of a dynasty that is now asserting her turn for the presidency. Now, you can make of that what you will, but you cannot deny that whiteness is playing a role in this every bit as much as gender is. So what we are basically arguing is you can't have this myopia towards what's actually happening. If you actually look at the exit polls, this is one of the interesting things in Ohio, 18% of white voters said that race was important. That's nearly one-fifth. And of those, 76% voted for Hillary. That's almost the margin for victory. Of those who said gender was important, just a little less, 16%, and only 60%, she got a 60 to 40% bump in that. So basically the feminists who are making this argument are doing what we have been concerned that they've done for a long time. They're not acknowledging that race is playing a role in elevating Hillary as much as they claim that race is playing a role on the other side.
What's come out of this meeting when you sat down together with this group of across racial lines of feminists and progressives? What was the tone, and what do you think positive has come out of it?
Well, I think the tone was respectful. I think there was consternation expressed across the board. Many African-American feminists were quite reasonably disturbed about how the deployment of this feminism makes it difficult for us to organize as feminists in our community. Those who were very concerned about misogyny in the media were quite concerned that we stand united in denouncing that. So I think that there was some agreement on that. I think where we still do not have agreement is on the damage and the dangers of doing this ranking business. I mean, the idea that Barack, for example, because he's a man, will appeal more to men, that's an advantage, just completely ignores what's going on with black men. You look at prisons, you look at who's shot by the police, this idea that black masculinity is somehow a big advantage just is blind to the current reality. So I don't think we left with a sense that we have to really understand what was so disturbing about Gloria's piece, about Robin Morgan's piece. I think we left with a sense that it is important to recognize that feminism will transcend this election. We will still have issues to be dealt with afterwards. I think we've got agreement on that, but we don't have an agreement, I don't think, on how difficult the rhetorics are making life for those of us who want to organize as women of color and who are feminists.
I'm going to have to ask you to keep this really tight.
Sure.
But are you afraid that some Obama supporters will not vote for Hillary Clinton if she's the nominee?
Well, what my concern is that by the time the scorch and burn tactics of the Clintons are done with, it's not Obama supporters. It's people who really care about a fair democratic process. So I have concerns, and I think the party ought to be concerned that at the end of this, we have a unified party, not one in which the only one that can go forward is the one who's not bloodied.
Well, Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kimberly Crenshaw is a professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles, and at Columbia University. She joined me from Los Angeles. And just ahead, we've got our Africa update. Uganda talks peace and unity, plus President Mugabe tells foreign and white-owned businesses to hand more than half of their operations to indigenous Zimbabweans. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. This week on Africa Update, historic peace talks in northern Uganda, plus a new law in Zimbabwe requires foreign and white-owned companies to hand over control to black Zimbabweans. For more, we've got Amira Wood. She's co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Hi, Amira.
Hey, Farai. Great to be with you.
So, you know, let's talk about Uganda. Steps are underway to end the nearly two decades long civil war that was in northern Uganda. There are new peace talks between the Ugandan government and the rebel group known as the Lord's Resistance Army, or the LRA. And just last month, the two groups signed a permanent ceasefire, a peace agreement. A final peace agreement is expected to be signed before the end of the month. Is this really the end?
Well, we sure hope so. Let's remember the UN, well over 3 years ago, called the crisis in northern Uganda the worst humanitarian situation in the world. They describe it as worse than Iraq. That was 3 years ago. Clearly, over that time, things have escalated. You have had people forced out of their homes. You have had the continuous abuse of children, with child soldiers being used as a weapon throughout that conflict in northern Uganda. So it is tremendous that we are at the point now of seeing an end at long last to the crisis. I think it's testament to the African Union and the mediation and negotiation efforts that they have put forward to kind of keep all sides to the table. It is also really a testament to the international community. Let's remember, Farai, the International Criminal Court indicted one of the participants in that conflict, Joseph Kony, and that indictment is seen as a key element in bringing us to this point where both sides are negotiating what now looks like a standing peace agreement.
How are these negotiations different from other ones that have taken place in the past? Are there any different stipulations that could keep both sides honest?
Well, I think there are key elements of, you know, disarming various factions, demobilizing soldiers, reconstituting a national army that reuses really the factions' fighters and kind of creates a space where those who were former rebel leaders are able to kind of put down their weapons and move forward towards peace. I think what is at issue is really a space where civil society, human rights activists are able to kind of continue their clamorings for peace and are able to keep all sides honest. I think this is what will hold this agreement true. And I think also vigilance by the international community to what extent, and we really don't know, to what extent will the International Criminal Court's response actually detaining or arresting one of the leaders after they may have signed a peace agreement. These are the unknowns now that will determine whether or not this agreement is lasting.
I want to move on to Zimbabwe. The president, Robert Mugabe, just approved a new business ownership law. It requires every white-owned or foreign-owned company to hand over 51%, so controlling interest, in their company to indigenous Zimbabweans. If not, the government said it's going to block any new investments, mergers, or restructuring. So first of all, how is the government defining anyone who's an indigenous Zimbabwean?
Well, they're essentially looking to see who are their supporters 3 weeks before an election. Who are the supporters is a critical element in this discussion around the whole nationalizing and ownership of these assets. So on one level, we can look and say, yes, Zimbabwe is doing what many countries are doing, whether it's Russia or Venezuela, you know, trying to claim a rightful ownership over natural resources. And let's remember, there's diamond, there are tremendous mining opportunities in Zimbabwe, which is, you know, it's critical, I think, that there is resource rights asserted by countries around the world. But given that it is just so close to the election, Farai, it does seem like this is much more to appease those who are supporters of ZANU-PF, the government of Robert Mugabe, to essentially say, well, if you stick with Mugabe, you get even more of the crumbs. And we know the situation in Zimbabwe with, you know, historic high 10,000% inflation rates, with, you know, 80% unemployment, clearly dangling these potential carrots could play a role in the election process.
The devaluation of the currency in Zimbabwe has become a very bitter joke. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, op-ed cartoons and you know, people riffing on how worthless the currency is. Is there still a place for international investment there in the sense that are there still people making money there?
Well, again, let's remember Zimbabwe was once the agricultural breadbasket, and clearly the whole agricultural sector has taken a huge hit in recent years. But there are other sectors that have continued to do well, and I think those are the sectors that will look to these carrots being dangled by Mugabe with interest.
What do we know about the elections? What do we know about these upcoming elections in terms of there's a bit of a three-legged race with the former finance minister, Simba Mokone, and the longtime opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai. So how are these candidacies playing out in the current political context?
Well, clearly the political context is incredibly curtailed and constrained. So there is no freedom of the press. There is really no freedom to organize or to assemble. So it's a climate that is repressive still. And with the economic downturns, there's a sense of a real desperate situation throughout the country. So it's not an ideal moment in terms of an election. And let's remember again, there have been issues of changes of the constitution to even get to this point where Mugabe is standing. So it will be a hotly contested electoral process. And I think it's only telling that, you know, one from Mugabe's own party has now, Simba Mokone has now kind of split off and is presenting himself as a candidate as well. So it's going to continue to get murky, I would suspect, as the days and weeks go on before the election takes place.
Let's take a quick look at something going on in another part of the continent, China. of course, not part of Africa, but heavily invested in Sudan, Sudanese oil, Sudan, Darfur, China being criticized by outsiders, Westerners in particular, saying that China needs to pull back either from Sudan or use leverage to get Sudan to up its human rights standards. Now, last month, Steven Spielberg quit as artistic advisor for the Games. Is that kind of an action going to really change? And when I say the Games, I mean the Olympics. Is that kind of action going to change China's policy? Are we seeing any signs that China is beginning to use its leverage to force change in Sudan?
Well, I think you're seeing a change in rhetoric, Farai, and let's be clear. There has been a clamoring of voices, civil society voices in Africa, around the world, but here in the U.S. as well. So Steven Spielberg, it's Mia Farrow, it's a bunch of people who use their own personal acclaim to draw attention to China's role in the Olympics and using the Olympics as an opportunity to bring pressure for changes in terms of the Darfur and the international communities. Real pressure on the government of Khartoum to end the genocide, to end the crisis there in Darfur. So, you know, it's tremendous, as you've seen this come first from an idea from, you know, professors about a year ago, Eric Reeves and others, professors who thought, well, let's try to see if pressure can be brought to bear on China. And from that time, a year and a half ago to this point, to see that at least in rhetoric, there are some changes. So what you see in this recent trip by China to Darfur is a sense of China trying to do all that, you know, at least publicly in terms of the photo ops, all that it can. They have brought forward engineers and teams of engineers to help with the African peacekeepers on the ground in Darfur. They have made available Chinese peacekeepers as well. But clearly China has this critical role to play as a key trading partner and a key interest in Sudan's oil. They have a critical role to play. And these next 5 months before the election are going to be a critical period in which human rights activists that are concerned about Darfur, human rights activists that are concerned about Tibet and a range of other internal issues in China are going to use this platform of the Olympics to try to raise the level of pressure on China to do what
Amira,
it can.
Thanks so much, Amira.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. She joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. And in the southern part of Uganda, there's a kingdom called Buganda. It's located along the northern shore of Lake Victoria. Buganda is the largest of four regions in Uganda. It's a kingdom within the republic. The kingdom has a constitution, a parliament, and a prime minister. The former prime minister of the Bugandan kingdom, Daniel Muliika, recently spoke with NPR's Tony Cox.
Let's talk first, because I don't know how many people in our listening audience are familiar with Buganda and its history. What I have read suggests that it was a kingdom, and then when Uganda was formed, it became a kingdom within Uganda. But in 1966, under Milton Obote, that autonomy was taken away and it became a part of Uganda, the nation, and remains so today.
Okay, thank you. Buganda is a nation in itself. Its history dates far back over 3,000 years. It's a kingdom with chain of kings coming in. In fact, during the discovery of Africa by Europeans, Buganda had its own set up, a good government from king to katikiro, the Luchiko, which is parliament of Buganda, then the chiefs, county chiefs, sub-county, and parishes, then village chiefs. And the word katikiro, which is prime minister, which you call prime minister, means the one at the peak of all others reporting direct to Kabaka. So Kabaka entrusts the katikiro to govern the country on his behalf. And our Buganda, the kingdom, is an institution. It works as an institution, not individual, on each and everything.
You are a kingdom within Uganda. Buganda is a kingdom, a monarchy, correct?
Mm.
Is that the appropriate form of government for the 21st century in Africa?
It is, because people should be governed the way they feel they are free to be governed. In fact, our kingdom is even ahead of the other so-called unitary governments, because our institution is an institution. It does not act as Kabaka as a person when Yusuf Mutebi is doing it. Whatever he does as an institution, it's filtered. It's the people's will. And that's why we feel we should not be changed.
What is the current relationship between Buganda and Uganda? Is there, because you said that Buganda is a nation, but is it a sovereign nation separate and apart from Uganda, or is it a part of Uganda?
Okay. When the colonials came, we were integrated with other tribes, and we formed Uganda Protectorate, which eventually became the Republic of Uganda. So the Republic of Uganda is an aggregation of different tribes or different nations for that matter, Buganda being one. And Buganda is the biggest of all, is in the center of it, and we are situated on the equator. North of Uganda is Sudan. East of Uganda is Kenya. South of Uganda is Tanzania. West is Rwanda and Congo. That's where we are found on the equator. Now, during the colonial times, Buganda was independent in a way because it was enjoying a federal status, and we got our independence on 8th October 1962, and the rest of Uganda got their independence on the 9th October 1962. So Buganda went as a state to join other states, and then we formed the country Uganda under that 1962 agreement.
What is the relationship today between Buganda and Uganda?
The relationship today is Buganda doesn't want to secede, but Buganda wants its autonomy. Buganda joined even the current President Museveni to fight off the bad regimes of Amin and Obote. And when Museveni came to power, we thought and we believed that he's going to return our status. But now that is where the problem is. Instead of returning our land, which was grabbed in 1967, he's continuing making laws depriving Buganda of its land.
Is it possible, sir, to become autonomous again without seceding from Uganda? How is that possible?
It is possible if we go back by sitting on a table and stakeholders all come together. One thing is important. The central government should not be our masters. It's these 13 tribes which came together to form Uganda under 1962 agreement, which must sit together and agree on a formula of running Uganda together. But now the government is imposing itself and it's taking away people's power.
Talk for a moment, if you will, about life in Buganda and particularly how it is impacted, for example, by the unrest in neighboring Kenya.
The internal problems of Kenya would affect Buganda, because what is the cause in Kenya? One tribe has dominated others, but because of that concentration of power into one tribe, it has exploded. They have just been on sitting on a powder keg. That's what we want to avoid in Uganda. We are telling central government the distribution of land must remain with their own, because there are channels on through which the central government can get land amicably. One of it is willing buyer, willing seller. That one is okay. Another one is the compulsory clause which we put in our constitution, that if central government wants land for the use of the public, let's say road, hospital, whatever, we agree they can take the land. But before it is taken, parliament has to approve to ensure that it's public interest. Two, the indigenous communities concerned in that particular area have also to confirm it is a public interest. Then three, the one who is holding that piece of land which is going must be fully compensated on market value. And that's the problem. Why we don't see the reason then why government again wants to jump over other people's land. We know how to govern ourselves. They have used methods of evicting people so that we feel there is insecurity. And now when the land is badly distributed, we are going to have Zimbabwe case. You remember that Zimbabwe, even after 100 years of colonization, still they are telling you, let's land go back to its indigenous people.
Sir, thank you very much for coming in. I really do appreciate it. It's fascinating, and I've learned a great deal about Buganda. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dan Malika was Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Buganda from 2005 to 2007. He spoke with NPR's Tony Cox. And next on News and Notes, Essence Magazine's Grand Dame Susan Taylor joins me to talk about her new book, All About Love. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. For more than 20 years, Susan Taylor personified the spirit of Essence magazine. Every month, she shared her thoughts and life with millions of readers through her column, In the Spirit. Her new book expands on some of the best In the Spirit writings. It's called All About Love, favorite selections from In the Spirit on Living Fearlessly. We spoke not long ago about the power of living in the moment.
It's been so surprising to me that my column has touched people, and what I've written about are the things that I'm grappling with. My hope is that people don't think that I have it all together, and sometimes they do, you know, but I don't care how much you know, how many books you read, how much you study, and, you know, how educated you are, you're still going to struggle. Life is challenging. You know, we have everything we need to handle those challenges, to meet them. But it's the feedback that I've gotten from readers over the years that has just made me humble and really grateful that I have something to share.
One of the things that struck a chord with me in the book is when you talk about not being in the moment and always wanting to be more than, different than, and how we can slip into that mindset. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Parai, I missed so much of my life, particularly as a young mother. You know, when my daughter was born, I wanted her not to be an infant, but to be a toddler. And when she was a toddler, I wanted her to be able to button her own clothes and get herself dressed and help me get her out the door. And when she was probably around 10 or 11, I wanted her to be 13, 14. And then I wanted her to be out of high school and in college. And when I looked back on that exquisite journey, I realized that I missed so many moments, so many precious moments, because I wasn't present. My mind was always far down the road.
Do you think that you've been able to conquer that?
You know, it's what I work on in the everyday of my life. And at this age and stage of my life, I have a new peace, you know, and because I think I have a deeper understanding of what's important. When I joined Essence, I was a young single mother. I was 24. I hadn't gone to college. I wasn't making any money at Essence. $500 a month? And I was struggling. So I was always looking down the road, always hoping for a better, you know, tomorrow. And it was a very painful situation. One day, having such anxiety that I thought I was actually having a heart attack at 24. And I ended up in the hospital in the emergency room. And the doctor told me that it wasn't a heart attack, but an anxiety attack that I was having. And when I left the hospital and started walking up Broadway in New York City, and I looked up and I saw a marquee that said church service at 3 p.m. And I heard a sermon that changed my life. And it was that very painful, painful day that helped me to realize that in this moment, if no matter what we're challenged with, if we get still, if we listen within, if we stop biting our nails and faring and just running around in circles, that there's a wisdom within us that will begin to unfold. And that's what I came to that day. So I really try to honor living in the present moment. Not that I'm successful every day, but I certainly am working at it.
You talked about when you were a young single mother, not making much at Essence, just the stress you were under. A lot of people feel that material stress, having questions about whether or not you're going to be able to feed your family, keep a roof over your head, all that stuff. That's one of the biggest stressors in people's lives. How is there any way that you put that into context in particular?
You know, I write about that in the chapter on abundance, and I'll tell you, the greatest stress I have had in my life, it hasn't been drama in the workforce. It hasn't been relationships, even though, I mean, my heart ached when my first marriage, you know, just bit the dust and my husband fell in love with somebody else or found somebody else. I don't think he fell in love with her, but she was certainly his woman and I was just cast aside. The greatest stress was really not being able to pay my bills, not knowing whether I could feed my daughter or keep that roof over my head. So it was the financial crises that I've had in my life that have really pained me the most. And this is what I learned. And this is when my face had to hit the floor. We live in an abundant universe. Everything we need to take care of ourselves, those things are all around us. Don't focus on that economy. Don't believe that there's not enough for you. And what we have to do is contain ourselves. You know, you can't live large. You know, Farai, what people don't know about me, oh, Susan Taylor, you know, the one who is in the magazine and we see her on television and I know she has a fabulous life. What people don't know is that I slept in my living room for 27 years because all I could afford when I moved into that beautiful building across from Lincoln Center in New York was a one-bedroom apartment. My daughter had the bedroom and I had the living room. I built a bed, sort of like a banquette type of bed into the wall right there in the living room. And what I began to do was I started saving my lunch money and not, you know, going out and spending money on things that I didn't have. Now that happened after a dispossess notice went up on my front door. And I'll tell you, I bought my first property in Harlem by saving my lunch money over years. There's a whole piece on that. And it's called, you know, Do the Math. Don't identify yourself with labels and brands and have to buy every cute thing you see. Invest in the things that will grow in equity. That's really the key. Invest in real estate. Invest in stocks. Watch them. Don't turn your financial well-being over to people. Don't lose your house in this mortgage crisis. What can you do if you have to wash cars, drive a cab, bake pies? Do what you need to do to hold on to your property and to recover your life.
You talk in the book about the ritual of journaling and it being liberating and healing. Why do you think it's important to write down what you have been through, what you hope, your aspirations?
As we write, what we do is we see what we're living through and we gain clarity. And I think it's, you know, writing and speaking the truth, telling people what we're going through, not hiding our pain, not hiding our confusion, helps us to heal and helps those who are listening to heal.
Susan Taylor is the editor-in-chief emeritus for Essence Magazine. Her new book is All About Love, Favorite Selections from In the Spirit on Living Fearlessly. In Black America, the term passing is used to describe light-skinned people who hide their African-American heritage. Take that idea, mix it with the horrors of lynching in the early 20th century, add a journalist's quest to document it, and you've got the premise for Matt Johnson's new graphic novel, Incognegro.
Between 1889 and 1918, 2,522 Negroes were murdered by lynch mobs in America that we know of. Now, since the beginning of the 30s, most of the white papers don't even consider it news. To them, another dead is not a story. So my job is to make it one. That's all.
Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So those were the words of Zane Pinchback. That's the novel's hero. The story is set in the 1930s. Set up the plot for us.
The 1930s, it was kind of the end of the lynching campaign that had basically happened since Reconstruction all the way through. A large portion of the African-American kind of alpha males were pretty much wiped off the face of the country in an effort to terrorize the Black community and also kind of keep it pruned and powerless. And my main character is an African-American who looks mostly white, someone who is inspired by my own experience and also by historical figures like Walter White. And what he does is go into the South and investigate lynchings, find out who's responsible, and then bring that news to the North to try and raise awareness about what was happening in the country.
Walter White worked with the NAACP in the 20s and 30s. He was a journalist, and he was very much undercover when he went out and did his work. What kind of strength do you think it took for someone like him, who you say you've modeled your hero after, to go out and to patently hostile territory.
Walter White is a really fascinating character. I mean, he's not, when you look at his entire history, he's not a perfect human being by far. In some ways, he was so giving and so generous and did things like risking his life to investigate lynchings. But in other instances, he was just kind of clueless. But one of these characters that almost gets forgotten because he doesn't fit into our understanding of American history. And, you know, as a writer, that's what makes him kind of fun to use him as source material.
Now, this is a graphic novel, and you worked with an artist named Warren Pleece. There have been other stories that, you know, do well, serious stories in the graphic novel format. Mouse made a lot of ripples when it came out about the Holocaust. What do you like about the format, since you've used it before?
Well, I'm primarily a prose writer. I write what's usually considered literary fiction. And with this story, this was about movement. And particularly with something like this, looks are important here. But how people could kind of move between a black world and a white world is important.
It's a really beautiful noir format. The graphics are. What was it like to work with someone who was in the UK and to try to do all this coordinating of this story?
Well, I had to, at first I really felt the urge, like I had to show him imagery of African Americans who looked white, because I thought, like, that's just going to blow his mind. I mean, I lived in Britain in the past, and that kind of identity really doesn't exist there. It's a very American phenomenon. So I sent him pictures of, like, Jennifer Beale and, like, Wentworth Miller from Prison Break, and I even sent him a picture of Carol Channing and said, she's one, too.
That's right.
just so he would get the idea. But for a year, every month or so, 10 pages, 20 pages would just kind of show up in the mail. And I would look at it, and it would be exactly what I imagined. And, you know, that's just tells me that we chose the right person to collaborate with.
Now, will you read us a little bit more about your hero's journey?
The main character, Zane Pinchback, and his buddy Carl just arrived in the southern town, and they're being taken into town by one of the locals, an African-American man who's pulling them on a horse and buggy, and Zane and Carl are sitting in the back asking him questions. Carl, how the hell do they live down here? If it's this bad, why don't they all just go north? Lots of folks do, but it ain't all bad. It ain't always this bad. There's been trouble. Folks got riled. What kind of trouble? A woman was found killed, Michaela Mathers, out in the woods past town. But they caught a man, think they got the right one. What do you think? You think they got the right one? Don't matter what I think. They got Alonzo Pinchback, that boy they call Pinchy. Locked up down the sheriff's. Suspect he'll pay for it. Pinchback? The person who's been arrested for murder this time is his own brother. And he has a brother who looks more African, brown skin. So that's where the kind of the reader discovers that that our main character has a personal connection, and this event is going to be different from all the other ones.
How did you relate to the situation that you set up with these brothers?
Well, my own children, I have twins, 2 years old. One looks more European and has, you know, pink skin and red hair. And my daughter looks more African, has brown skin and has tighter curled African style hair. And I think when they were born, it kind of inspired me because it made me think, if this was a different era, if this was another time, then they would have had such dramatically different lives and such dramatically different opportunities. And it's an exciting, you know, point to be in at this time where, you know, especially lately we see that we're not as limited as we are in the past. But it also makes me want to explore that past.
Reading the book, there's a lot of white characters, and none of them are up to much good. Has that been a criticism that's come your way as people have read the book?
Sometimes when you have a world where people are at war, you don't always have to say why they're at war. If you have a World War II story, you don't have to qualify why the German soldiers are fighting for the Nazi army. You can just kind of do it. And I think that's what I was interested in here. I was also interested in really kind of coming in squarely behind the perspective of the main characters, of the African-American characters, and trying to get their story out. Because at the time, their story really didn't exist in the mainstream press or in the mainstream imagination. That's part of what this is about. It's about them putting this story out there.
Matt Johnson. His latest book is the graphic novel Incognigro. You can find out more about the novel and view a multimedia presentation from this interview on our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. On Tuesdays, we listen in on StoryCorps Griot, the project that's recording the stories of African Americans across the country. Today's story begins in New York's Sing Sing Prison. That's where Daryl Downs was serving time for robbery in the late 1970s. He recently came to StoryCorps to talk about discovering his passion and talent for art.
In prison, I started painting and drawing. And I can remember walking the yards and telling my homies, man, I'm going to be an artist. Yeah, man. They said, yeah, D, sure, yeah, right, D. I said, no, man, I'm going to be an artist, man. This is what I want to do. And from that point on, I painted every day. And one of the things I really remember was that when I was in prison, I read an article, and it says, you are measured by your time. That was very profound for me because even if I put one line on a canvas, at the end of the day, I could say I did something. And when I was leaving, it was a white guard. Never forget him. They had red hair and freckles. And he told me, he says, you'll be back. And I told him, I said, don't count on it. Because I knew that I was going to art school. It was no doubt in my mind. So when I got home, I got the applications. I had to go down for an interview. I took my paintings down so they could see them. And about 2-3 weeks later, I got the letter in the mail. It says, you've been accepted. You have a full scholarship. It was just, I can't even begin to describe how good a feeling it was to know that they saw a certain talent or certain worth in me. And I can remember walking into art school the first day, and it was students already there waiting for the teacher to come up, but they were all white. And when I walked in, all conversations among them stopped, and they turned and they looked at me. And the expressions on their face was like, what are you doing here? But I knew I wasn't going to stop. I just finished doing 66 months in the penitentiary, so there's no way in the world you was going to run me out of art school. I was here to learn. Now, I remember I would walk to the subway station, and I'd have my drawing box, and the guys would be on the corner. The guys I grew up with, they'd be on the corner. Hey, D, what's up? What's up? Where you going? I'm going to subway. I'm going to school, man. Okay. And I remember passing these guys night after night, and they were still on that corner. And it was like they were standing still in time. January 27th, 1977, I left prison. Never been back. Never. And it is a blessing, you know. It is a blessing.
That was Daryl Downs in Harlem. Daryl completed his studies at the Art Students League of New York in 1981. The public murals he's painted since then can be seen throughout New York City. StoryCorps Griot has finished its national tour, but you can still record your Griot interview at any StoryCorps booth around the country. All the Griot Initiative recordings are archived at the Library of Congress. A copy of each interview will also go to the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. Hear more at nprnewsandnotes.org.
Funding for StoryCorps Griot comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, some Ivy League schools are slashing tuition, but will the price cuts really help low-income students? I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.